Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. Like many in the space history community, I was deeply saddened by the news of the passing of legendary Apollo flight director Glenn Lunny on March 19th. So I reached out to our good friend and fellow flight director Jerry Griffin, and we put together this special remembrance you're about to hear. Jerry and flight controllers Jerry Bostick, Chuck Dietrich, and Bill Stovall will join us in a bit to reminisce about their friend and colleague, and we'll also hear some audio from Glenn Lunny, both recorded on this show for our Apollo 8 tribute back in 2018, and some mission audio from the Apollo 13 mission. But first, I wanted to connect with Apollo historian Andrew Chaikin. He wrote the seminal book, A Man on the Moon, and knew Lunny well, so I asked him to briefly give us insight into how Glenn Lunny fit into the pioneering era of crewed space exploration back in the 1960s and 70s. Andy Chaikin, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure, Dave. I met Glenn for the first time when I was 18 on my very first visit to NASA. And so I have great memories of going all the way back.
Yes, you do. And you're such a great historian of the Apollo program and NASA. Could you just give us a really brief, you know, biography? Why is this man so important in the history of space flight in the United States and the world?
Well, one way to answer that is to just say that, you know, Glenn was in the thick of things from the very earliest days of the space program. I mean, he was getting involved right after college in 1958, when they were still trying to figure out, you know, what space flight was and how to design a capsule that could carry an astronaut. And then, you know, as he joined NASA and became more directly involved, he graduated to being a flight controller in mission control on the Mercury missions. You know, he was the flight dynamics officer in the trench, what we know of as the select few in the front of mission control who were figuring out things like flight paths and trajectories and things. And, you know, he lived through the crisis with John Glenn's heat shield, for example, on Friendship 7. And then he went on to become a flight director on Gemini, which was, of course, the program that came between Mercury and Apollo and was kind of a training ground for the moon. And so, you know, in that capacity, as one of the very first, really the first four flight directors that NASA had, he was really on the front lines with whatever could happen, you know, and you better be prepared for whatever could happen. Things like Gemini 8 spinning out of control, things like Gene Cernan's spacewalk from hell. And one of the things that he was so essential about was the development of what are called mission rules. And that is a kind of a Bible for how you deal with crises. And they started that work way back on Mercury. They refined it during Gemini. Really, that was the kind of the maturing process for NASA. And then, of course, Apollo became, you know, the graduation day to go, move on to the big time. And Glenn was a flight director on Apollo. And most notably, that when the explosion happened on Apollo 13, after Gene Kranz's team signed off and handed it over to Glenn and his team, he gave what has been called one of the most absolutely magnificent performances ever. Just the way he brought order to chaos in that situation. He got his team marching in the same direction to, you know, close out the command module, the mothership, move into the lunar module, get that going so that they could be in a position to continue and get back on the right flight path. All of that was happening, you know, within the first couple of hours after the explosion, and Glenn was at the helm.
Yeah, and he just brought that sense of calm.
Yeah.
And you know, here's what we're going to do, and just brought this calm orderliness to the situation that allowed them time, you know, to keep the astronauts safe and then allow the long range plans to develop to get them back to Earth.
Yeah. And you know what I've really come to understand, you know, Glenn was a friend and mentor to me on the work that I've been doing as a historian, particularly more recently on success and failure in spaceflight, you know, I've come to really understand that that performance on Apollo 13 lines up so beautifully with the kind of person he was just in everyday life. Unflappable, calm. And that doesn't mean that he didn't have very strong feelings about what he saw going on in the world and what he saw even going on at NASA in the years since he had retired. But he was always balanced in his point of view and beautifully expressive in talking about what he knew, what he had learned from that amazing career.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just a beautiful way he had of talking about his love for mission control. Could you just briefly talk about that?
Well, I came across this in an oral history that he gave a number of years ago, and I was so struck by it because he referred to mission control as a kind of church or a cathedral. And, you know, Glenn was a spiritual guy. He had I think he had a deep faith. I never really talked to him much about that. But, you know, his spirituality extended to the work that he mastered in how do you do this audacious, incredibly unforgiving activity called spaceflight. And he looked back on his involvement in that with a sense of joy and gratitude. I mean, he talked about Bob Gilruth, who created that culture, the culture of human spaceflight, and Chris Kraft, who was molded by Gilruth and who in turn molded Glenn and the other flight directors. He talked about with them with such reverence. And looking back, especially in the early years when they were in their 20s, you know, in mission control. And he said, I just am endlessly amazed at the responsibility that they gave us, the trust that they placed in us. And I have come to understand that that is absolutely one of the key elements of the success that NASA had, how we got to the moon. And it still is today one of the key principles of success in spaceflight.
And before we let you go, he was also, you know, as you said, friend and mentor to you. Tell us just a bit about, you know, how you got to know him and what he was like, you know, as a person from your point of view.
Well, as I say, I met him for the first time when I was 18. I looked a heck of a lot younger than that. Wandered into the administration building with a buddy of mine. We just had a chance to visit JSC. And he came out of his office, program manager for Apollo Soyuz, and he said, hello, boys. He was so welcoming. And that spirit just kind of continued. And I interviewed him for Man on the Moon, of course, because he was just so integral to the Apollo missions. But then more recently, interviewing him about the shuttle program and the lead up to the Challenger accident and some of the lessons that he had to share about that. And I just always found him to be, above all, generous and really a great teacher. And he knew that he had benefited from the teachers that he had encountered at NASA. He said they were mentored by just about everybody they came in contact with, and he paid it forward. And that's, he was a guy who just instinctively wanted to do the right thing and not an ego-driven person. And that combination and the intelligence, let me not forget to say this. I have had many conversations with NASA veterans, both from Apollo and later, who talk about him as just the smartest guy they had ever run into. And so the combination of the intelligence, the integrity, the kindness, the generosity, you know, this is why it's going to be so hard to get over losing him. And I will be thinking about him very, very often.
The best thing I can say is that how fortunate you are to have called him your friend.
I feel absolutely blessed to be able to say that.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our tribute to Apollo-era NASA Flight Director Glenn Lunny with four of his closest colleagues, Flight Director Jerry Griffin and Flight Controllers Jerry Bostick, Chuck Dietrich, and Bill Stovall. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to a special edition of Blue Dot's Apollo at 50 series. Let's continue now as we look back at the life of NASA Flight Director Glenn Lunny with four of his closest colleagues, Flight Director Jerry Griffin and Flight Controllers Bill Stovall, Chuck Dietrich, and Jerry Bostick.
I just would like you guys to just introduce yourselves, your role in Mission Control, what you did, and the years you worked there. So let's start with you, Chuck. Just give us a quick profile of how you came to NASA and what your role was in Mission Control.
Well, I started in 1964, and actually Glenn Lunny interviewed me and hired me in August of 64. And I worked and I was in the flight dynamics branch with Glenn and the rest of the guys. And my job was to be a retrofire officer, which was to do the return to Earth studies, the abort studies, and do that stuff for the control center. And so I've known Glenn for a long time.
And Jerry Bostick, you're next.
Well, I worked in Mission Control, starting out at what was in Cape Canaveral, the Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and Skylab flights. In the Mercury Control Center at the Cape, I was there for the last two Mercury flights as a backroom support. I supported Glenn Lunny, who was the flight dynamics officer, and Carl Huss, who was the retrofire officer. I did that through Gemini 2 and then, Gemini 3. And then for Gemini 4, we moved to Houston.
And Bill Stovall, you're next.
I was hired in 1967 after I graduated from the University of Wyoming. I had had a fraternity brother named Dave Reed, who was a flight dynamics officer already in Houston. And he sort of rushed me like you do a fraternity rush. And I did all the paperwork and sent it all in, and lo and behold, I was hired by Mr. Lunny, who was my branch chief at the time, and Jerry Bostick, who was my section head at the time. Started working in July of 67, and I stayed until my father passed away in 1976, and I came back to Wyoming and took over the family business. So Glenn and Jerry were my first two bosses. Couldn't have done any better.
No. And well, boss, what about you?
Well, this is Jerry Griffin, the other Jerry in this foursome. I got to NASA in late June of 1964. And I met Glenn somewhere in the next month or two. And then the first time I saw him in action was Gemini 2, which, to remind the audience, was the second unmanned flight test of the Titan booster, essentially. We controlled that one from the Cape, from the old Mercury Control Center. That's the first time I saw Glenn in action. It's also where I saw Bostick and some of the other guys that, like Chris Kraft, that I would work with for the next several years. Then I was a GNC through all of Gemini. I was a guidance, navigation, and control systems guy. And I worked with the trench guys, the three on this shift now. At one time or another, we were all together and sometimes all together. And then right after the fire, Kraft decided he needed three more flight directors. So he reached down and plucked three of us, and I was fortunate enough to be one of them. And then I sat beside Glenn Lunny at the flight director console, essentially for the rest of the program. And what a treat that was. But anyway, all of us go back to kind of that same generation of time. And it's amazing that today we're still all here and can talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to know about, like, what were your first impressions of Glenn Lunny? Like, when did you, for each of you, when do you remember your first real encounter working with him and getting to know him as a person? Do you have any, like, earliest recollections?
Well, I was retro on a first unmanned Apollo mission, which was 201, which we launched a spacecraft down and landed in the Atlantic Ocean, just a lob shot. And Glenn was the flight director for that particular mission. And it turns out the mission kept getting scrubbed. So we did lots of sims. So, of course, he was my branch chief. So I did get to know him really well because we worked for him. So that's kind of where I started with him. And of course, he was a flight director on Apollo 7 and what have you. So to me, he really had a uncanny insight that could see things that were going on. He could really tell what needed to be done, what didn't need to be done. He was really a clever fellow.
So this is Bill. My first recollection of Glenn and his of me, Dave Reed and I were walking outside of the Space Center on July 4th of 67. I had just come to work. I was wearing a pair of corduroy pants and a long sleeve shirt. And Glenn and Marilyn came driving up and stopped, and Glenn got out and he said, "You must be my new hire from Wyoming." That was one of his favorite stories, and he never forgot it.
Wow. I love that.
You know, I've got a memory of him that two of them. The first time I saw Glenn in Mission Control at the Cape, I thought, my gosh, that guy is so young. He must have found his way in here by mistake or something. He was a very, very youthful, about mid-20s at that point. And then I remember him, my first, I worked with him in Gemini when he was still a FIDO and then later as a flight director. But when I moved up to be closer to him, I guess I'd say as a flight director, Apollo 7, he was the lead flight director. That was the first manned flight after the fire. I watched him closely during that mission because for a number of reasons. One, he was not real happy with Wally Schirra, and Wally was kind of grumpy during that mission, and he handled it really well. He was very frustrated. Obviously, I guess he thought, here was my first crack at Apollo and the lead flight director role, and we got this roughness going on between the crew and the ground. But he handled it beautifully, and he came out of it, and I learned a lot then about Glenn Lunny. And kind of like Chuck said, he could kind of get a bunch of problems all together and put them in a basket and sort them out and always seemed to come up with the right answers. He was that way his entire career.
Glenn was the third person that I met at NASA in January of 1962. I first met Chris Kreitzes, who was an administrative officer. He said, "We can't hire you because you have a degree in civil engineering and working for aeronautical and mechanical and electrical, not civil." And so I was actually leaving the room very dejected, and then walks Chris Kraft. And Chris just explained to him why he didn't want to hire me. And Kraft said, "Why do you want to come to work for us?" I said, "Well, I've been working over to Langley Research Center. And unfortunately, I found out I'm not too adapted to research. I like to work on problems, known problems, and try to come up with immediate solutions. And so he turned to Creatures and he says, "Hell, Haim, we might need somebody to survey the moon." And then he took me down the hall and he introduced me to Glenn Lutt. And I knew within the first couple of minutes in talking with Glenn that I definitely had made the right decision. He was not only a smart guy, but he was very nice. If he said, "How are you doing?" It wasn't just a conversation piece. He really meant it. He wanted to know if you were doing okay. And of course, after that, I ended up working with and for Glenn for the next 35 years. I think I was his assistant or deputy five times in that 35 years.
Well, the next question I'd like to ask, Jerry, this for our listeners, and all of you can chime in. For a lot of people, you know, you see like a movie like Apollo 13, for example, or you watch a launch on television today and you see, you know, a mission control room and all the consoles and all the people at them with their headsets on. But could you describe for us, Jerry, that really, you know, Glenn was in there along with Chris Kraft at the very beginning where this whole concept of flight control is invented. And could you just kind of describe for us what is the concept of flight control and how has it evolved through time to what it is as we know it today?
Which Jerry?
Jerry Griffin, sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, to me, I thought that there's no doubt that the father of mission control and the concept of how you do it was vintage Chris Kraft, and he had developed that from the flight test business with airplanes that he had been in earlier in his years at Langley, and he just tried to take it another step farther and get it into space. And he didn't have all the answers when he started, but he figured it out pretty quickly. And I think Glenn, my first recollection of him operating, particularly as a flight director, he was a clone of Chris Kraft. Even some of his mannerisms, the way he held his microphone key in his hand and just the way he would look and so forth. So I always thought that Glenn probably grasped what Chris had in mind very early on. And that's what he did for the rest of his time in mission control. Now, he stayed under Kraft even as when he went on to the ASTP and all that. But Glenn was just, he could have done anything. Heck, he could have run NASA. Probably should have.
Anybody else?
Well, one thing about Glenn was that, you know, he came out of flight dynamics area. And but when he was the flight director, he would never second guess anybody, and especially the flight dynamics people. He would let us do our job. And Jerry Griffin was kind of the same way. But that was one thing that really impressed me about Glenn. He obviously knew the answer, but he wouldn't second guess you. He'd always let you work it on yourself.
Well, I never agree with that. Of course, you know, as Chuck pointed out, he had been a flight dynamics officer, and so he really understood what we were doing. And you would think that would be, you know, kind of nerve-wracking, but no, it was wonderful because since he understood what our job was, he didn't question our responses or to situations. He knew if we were doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And there weren't many flight directors who grasped that. Jerry Griffin was one of them, certainly. But some of the other flight directors never really figured out what we did in the trench. But Glenn obviously understood it, and Jerry Griffin figured it out very quickly.
Well, let me ask this then. Can you guys explain to us what goes on in the trench and what flight dynamics really is? What are you accomplishing? What's your job?
Well, the flight dynamics team, which is the retrofit officer, the flight dynamics officer, and the guidance officer, are responsible for using ground-based radar to track the spacecraft and determine its state vector. That's its velocity and position and its attitude through the launch phase and into orbit and then to bring them back home during the entry phase. The retrofit officer, his main job is to use that state vector to continually calculate reentry possibilities as we go along in case there's a contingency and we have to reenter. And the flight dynamics officer, his main responsibility is to take that tracking data, and usually there is data from at least two different tracking stations and also the onboard navigation system and come up with the best state vector. And the guidance officer worries about the function of the guidance. How is the software guidance system working? Whereas the GNC, which is where Jerry Griffin started at, he was more concerned with the hardware, but the guidance officer in the trench was worried about the software, the guidance software.
Anybody else?
So, yeah, just to expand a little bit, as the mission wore on, the flight dynamics officer's role changed depending on what mission phase we were going into, whether it be the launch and TLI phase of the mission, whether it be the translunar, trans-Earth coast phase of the mission, moving into the lunar orbit, LOI, DOI were the maneuvers, descent to the moon, asset run. Every one of those required a different skill set, if you will. And the guys who were the best at it sort of shuffled the deck, and they could literally do almost anything. Some of it was very, very isolated, like descent. We only had a couple of guys that ever worked as a FIDO during descent. Ascent rendezvous, we only had a couple of guys who ever did that. But those skill sets were very unique and took a long time to develop. Thousands of hours of simulations, you know, hundreds of failures in simulations. Learning to work with the guidance officer, the retrofit officer, and the rest of mission control, going to meetings with the crews and the support crews and the backup crews, and then all the mission planning people. And it was an incredible job. You can't even begin to understand it unless you were one, and there weren't many of us. It was a dream of a lifetime, in as far as I'm concerned.
And very select people. As Glenn used to say, we aren't running this group for the slow learners.
You know, this is Jerry. Let me interject something kind of humorous. I know the three guys with me here will remember this, but and I'm pretty sure it was during the simulations for Apollo 7. And Glenn was really working hard to get the entire team, not just the trench, but everybody, the network, the instrumentation and communications guy, the systems people, the Capcom. And he was so smart. He was, somebody said it earlier, he knew the answer, but we had all been trained by Kraft. Don't pull it. Don't you make the decision, make the guy that's responsible for it, make it. But he was getting very frustrated and sometimes just on the verge of being angry during these sims. And one of our six flight directors in Apollo was a guy named Cliff Charlesworth. Cliff was from Mississippi. We called him the Riverboat Gambler. And he was an old FIDO. And he could work Glenn. Later years, he worked me over pretty hard when I was center director. But Cliff was amazing. He was to the point and could always see kind of what was going on. And I never will forget one sim, Glenn was about to come unglued, and Charles was kind of pulled him over to the side and said, "Lunny," he said, "you got to remember you're smarter than everybody else in here. And just tone it down, just calm down." And Glenn looked at him and got this sheepish grin on his face and said, "Okay." And he did. He calmed it down. And Apollo 7 worked out just fine. And Glenn got through all those sims. But the old riverboat gambler took him down a notch that day when he said, just calm down. You're smarter than all these people. They'll catch up with you.
That's great. Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we look back at the life of NASA Flight Director Glenn Lunny. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation between Apollo Flight Director Jerry Griffin and Flight Controllers Jerry Bostick, Chuck Dietrich, and Bill Stovall as we look back at the life and work of Flight Director Glenn Lunny, who recently passed away. They all worked together at NASA's Mission Control Room during the 1960s and 70s. Jerry Griffin, could you just set the stage for us as briefly as you can for people who may not be as familiar as we are with the Apollo 13 accident? What happened? When did it happen? And then when is it that Glenn's black flight team comes on board?
Yeah, the Apollo 13 was a wonderful mission until about 55 hours. We were about 200,000 miles from Earth and 40,000 miles or so from the moon, and an oxygen tank exploded, and it was really a serious problem. Of course, it ended the chance of landing on the moon on Apollo 13. I had been on shift and got off and turned it over to the white team, Gene Kranz's team, and in fact was out playing a softball game on site, and this tank exploded while Kranz's, the white team, was on. And of course, it was pretty chaotic in those first few minutes, very chaotic, trying to figure out what was going on first. And then about the time Glenn's black team came in to relieve that white team, and about the time that, and Glenn was overlapped, we overlapped our shifts. So he was there when part of this was going on. But it was time for a shift change, and Kranz went a little long with his team, not very too much over his time, and then Glenn took over. And it, at that point, it was still pretty chaotic. The decision had made to let's think about getting in the lunar module and powering it up and getting the CSM power off so we could save it, and that's where Glenn came in. And I think in that shift that he served. Right after that white team, it was probably one of the best pieces of flight control that happened in manned spaceflight to this time. Glenn's team, under his leadership, got things kind of calmed down in place, at least a plan started to get them home. And that's about all we did was plan from there forward. But Glenn's actions in that probably first 4 or 5 hours of about a 10-hour shift really calmed things down and got us on the right track to get home.
Well, let's take a little quick break here, and I'd like you guys to listen to a little audio clip that Matt's going to play for us from Apollo 13, from the flight director's loop. And just I want you to, you know, go ahead and react to it after you listen to it.
Okay, everybody, look, we got a number of long-range problems right now. We have the burn to do, which is at about 79 hours, 28 hours from now. And that's one business. We have to get the track up as we need it to take care of that burn. Hopefully we won't need to do too much with that, although I don't know how many amps that's going to take. However, right now, I want to be sure that we get the whole situation stabilized with the LEM and the CSM. We got to start bringing the LEM power down some and getting the non-required stuff off the line so that we don't use up any of these amp hours that we don't need to give away. And I want you to pay attention to the configuration we're currently in and get the people offline working on the longer range problems, especially the lifeboat problems now associated with the limb. You know, LIOH, etc. Let's get all that figured. But right now, I want the guys here in the room to concentrate on keeping this thing right now going along, all right, and watch it.
So, yeah, I'd like you, can you guys just react to what memories does that bring back for you about Glenn?
It brings back wonderful memories. As astronaut Ken Mattingly said, that when Glenn came on as the flight director, he totally took charge. He settled everybody down, and it was one of the best examples of management that you could ever find. When he first came in before into the control center, before he went up to take over as flight director, he stopped in the trench, and he talked to me and to Chuck Dietrich, and we said, Ben, the first thing we need to do is to get on a free return trajectory. And he immediately said, yes, I agree. That's what we need to do. So, you know, he being an ex-FIDO, he understood that, and he trusted me and Chuck anyway. And when he took charge, the whole room just kind of settled down and went about solving the problem one step at a time.
Well, yeah, no, he, Jerry, exactly right. Glenn did settle the room down. He listened to us when we said, hey, we need to get back on a free return. Now, it turns out the free return would actually, the cheapest one, put us on Africa. So we had a little bit more to put us in the Indian Ocean, just east of Madagascar. But he completely agreed that, yeah, the right thing to do is get him on a trajectory that's coming home, and we can do other things later on if we need to. But the first thing we need to do is get him coming in the right direction home.
This is Jerry Griffin. One for the audience, the free return comment means that if you're on the right trajectory, when you get to the moon, you'll go around on the backside. The gravity of the moon will change the trajectory and slingshot you around and bring you back to Earth without any maneuver. But as Chuck said, if you just stayed on that free return, we would have put them down in Africa, which is not good. So, like I say, add a little more velocity and put them in the Indian Ocean.
But at least when we're headed back to Earth, if we hadn't done the free return, we would have gone around the backside of the moon and headed back towards the Earth. But we would have missed it by how many miles, Chuck? About 6,000 miles or something?
I think somewhere between 1,500 and 2,500 miles. Yeah. And it turns out it's really interesting. If you look at the trajectory, we would have gone around Earth once, come around again the second time. The third time we go too close to the moon and we come almost, and it would slow us down. We come almost straight in on it. Of course, that was a month later. And of course, they would not survive. The consumer has been all gone. But yes, but a free return, because we were going out to the moon on a free return. Then we did a maneuver to make it cheaper to get into to do the descent. And that took us off the return trajectory, put us on a trajectory where we'd miss the Earth. And that's what we tried to fix to get it. Actually negate that maneuver, that what we call a hybrid maneuver, to get us back on a free return.
One of the things that happened, I was on the white team, and when the explosion occurred, and you know, everybody's looking at their data and thinking it's instrumentation, and the crew's talking, and I computed a free return transfer just because it seemed like the right thing to do. But I had no idea if we were really going to do it, because if we did, we had lost the lunar landing. And in that first hour, hour and a half, I don't think anybody was willing to stand up and say, it's over. We're coming home. Now, that happened fairly quickly. In that first hour, it was really sort of chaotic. Guys were looking at their stuff, and like I said, I was looking at that free return, and it wasn't obviously my decision, but it was a huge decision that had to be made, and fairly quickly. or we're going to have more difficulty. The other thing we had that explosion and all the venting and the gases going out and the spacecraft was bouncing around. We had a really crummy definition of a state vector by then, and tracking was being compromised by the venting. It was a very challenging hour and a half until the white team gave up to the black team. There were a lot of blank stares.
Can you explain to us, briefly, in layperson's terms, what the state vector is?
It's go ahead, Bostic. You're good at this.
The state vector describes the velocity, the speed of the spacecraft, its position in space, and its attitude, the attitude of the spacecraft. And that's what you have to know, the state vector, where it is, how fast it's going, and what its attitude is before you can calculate any other maneuvers.
And that's relative to the center of the Earth,
yes.
Okay? The velocity, inertial velocity relative to the Earth.
Assume you're going down the interstate freeway at 40 miles an hour headed towards San Antonio. That's your state vector. It's what time you're there and where you're going, which way you're headed, and how fast you're headed there.
That's great. I'm a physics teacher, so I know what it is, but the way you guys explained it was perfect. Thank you.
Well, and we computed it, as Jerry said a while ago, using tracking data from all over the world. And if that tracking data is compromised by an explosion or venting or whatever the spacecraft was doing, then your state vector is compromised. Your knowledge of where they are, how fast they're going, and extrapolating that 5 days later to re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, that's really guts poker. It's not state of the art.
Okay, let's talk about another of Glenn's amazing missions, which was the Apollo Soyuz test project, and he tells a story I've seen where I think it was Chris Kraft. Basically told him, hey, get ready, you're going to Moscow. And he's like, what? What do you think it was about Glenn Lunny that he was chosen to do that very first international cooperative mission in space?
He knew how to handle people. I went over there for a training session, and he had all the people in a room, and they were going over there. He says, now, I want you ladies and gentlemen to be ladies and gentlemen over there and behave yourselves. And I'll never forget that.
Well, this is Jerry Griffin. As I said earlier, the guy could have done anything. He went from operations, which is very much a hands-on, day in, day out task of making something that somebody else designed and somebody else built work. Ops was making all those pieces work. And he went straight from that to the other side of he was a program manager. He was actually making the program happen. And as we've all said, he was just excellent at it. He was a leader. They could call him a program manager and use that term, but there's a big difference between a manager and a leader. And he was a leader. He was not. He could manage. So could Chris Kraft. But Chris Kraft was a leader as well. We all wanted to do well for Chris. People wanted to do well for Glenn. That's a sign of leadership. And people were proud to work for them. And again, I'm kind of coming back to the fact they were very much alike. But Glenn. The respect just poured out of everyone's body toward him because they trusted him. And that leadership and trust is vintage Glenn Lunny.
No, if you read Glenn's book, he spent, in my opinion, an inordinate amount of time on the Russian flight. And I think it was because it was such a challenge to him from a standpoint of trying to orchestrate with all of those people over there and the language barriers and the attitude barriers. And it was just, I don't even know how many chapters he spent, but I'll bet he spends a quarter of the book on that ASTP program. I think he was really challenged by it, probably more so than anything he might have done in the control center. And that's just my opinion, but it really made a profound impression on him. I know that.
I think it was Glenn that told me a funny story about his time in Russia. He said they'd put him up in some hotel and they didn't have something in the room, probably towels or something. Anyway, he said all you had to do was just say, you know, I sure wish these people would provide the following and whatever it was. And he said it would show up. So he said somewhere in that room there were some bugs that were active because we never did have to go ask for anything. We just had to say it in our room.
Well, they obviously went through all of our stuff every day while we were away. I mean, they were pretty sloppy about it. You know, I positioned my clothes and everything, you know, exactly so I could tell if anybody had gone through it. And somebody went through it every day.
Got to remember the Cold War was, the wall hadn't come down yet.
Before we get finished, I'd like to know about, you know, what he was like, you know, away from the Space Center and, you know, when you'd socialize with him, what was Glenn like just as a person, as a human being, you know, when he was away from work?
Let me tell you a story. Glenn in the branch was pretty early on. He would have parties at his house and, we'd all the branch guys would go over there and have hamburgers or hot dogs. I don't know what a red bug is, but a red bug is a little bitty creature that you cannot see, but it likes to chew on you and it itches. And anyway, to make a long story short, his house, the backyard was up against Mary's Creek in Friendswood. Well, we had a party over there, I guess it was Sunday afternoon. And the next day, everybody who was at the party was scratching. Charlie Parker, I think, counted 122 bites on him. But Glenn was always good about, you know, he liked to do that kind of stuff. And he always, of course, we always had beer there.
So when I first signed up that first Thanksgiving, of course, I was in Houston all alone and da-da-da-da. Glenn decided he was going to have a Thanksgiving event for all the bachelors. And so we all showed up and had a wonderful Thanksgiving. And anyway, that morphed the next year into... I was married now, and my wife Ruth and Glenn and Marilyn had become great friends. So it sort of started becoming a party with the Lennies and ourselves. And we did 8 consecutive Thanksgivings with the Lennies. We were just part of the family. They're 4 kids, and Ruth and I, and Glenn and Marilyn. And we had so much fun and did so many things. And sometimes we'd grab 2 of the kids and take them back to La Porte with us so they could have a night with only 2 kids. And Marilyn never gave up all 4, but it was great fun. And Lennies were just incredibly social, wonderful people. And they never met a stranger. We were there at Glenn and Marilyn's last year, right before COVID, and we hadn't seen him in a long time. And we had 2 absolutely wonderful days. And I'm so glad we went because it had been a long time. And I knew that there were health issues. But did we have a good time. And it was almost like the 40 years had not even passed. It was so special. What a great, great family.
Before we go, is there anything else somebody wants to share along those lines before we close this out?
Well, I think there's one thing I'd like to, and I know you're aware of this, Dave, but take note of it, particularly with the fact now that we have the MOCR, the Mission Operations Control Room in Houston, restored fully back to the way it was when we walked out of there. And I think it was Glenn who started the thought that when he walked in there, and particularly maybe on Apollo 8, that it was like a cathedral. I think he was right on. In fact, it is like that today to me. When I walk back in there, it's like walking into a European giant cathedral. It feels like home too. And I think that is kind of the measure of Glenn Lunny and Mission Ops.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because Matt has one more clip to play for you.
It really was a wonderful thing. You know, the whole time we were there, I've come to call the control center, I call it our cathedral, and other people think of it as something different, but that was my sense of it. We were doing something spiritual when we did what we did, but especially when we went to the moon. It just seemed like, boy, you know, we're really doing something that's never been done before. It's a different place, and we have time here now, so we can actually do some exploring. And as Apollo went on, we did more and more of that. But it felt kind of spiritual that we, the human, was now operating in this place that was closest to us in the solar system. And we were doing something groundbreaking. We were doing something that people had never done before. Although how many people had looked at the moon and wondered? Probably everybody who walked on the Earth. And we were doing something that had a spiritual content. In the control center, you could tell people were emotionally reacting to what was going on. And everybody had their own private way of dealing with it, I guess. But there were a lot of damp eyes in the control center, and people just enjoying the fact that here we were a part of this unimagined thing. I mean, when we started off, this going to the moon was impossible.
Thanks again to our guests, Andrew Chaikin, Jerry Bostic, Chuck Dietrich, Bill Stovall, and a special thank you to Jerry Griffin for helping to plan this memorial tribute to his good friend and colleague, the late Glenn Lunny.
Look, as I see it, we got a number of things to do. No big hurry right now. We got to maintain calm here, of course, with the limb. But we need to see what we need to do about setting up a PTC attitude and an arrangement of control mode, and what that means relative to the ags and the pings configuration as to powering the ags down, etc.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And Godspeed, Black Flight.